Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Today we're going to be talking about plants that stand the test of time, maybe last the test of time, at least hardy ones. And we can fold in there some Valentine kind of plants, too, that we can talk about it. And maybe some Valentine plants that will last a long time and be around for your loved one. Liz Freemuth is in the studio with us. It's always great to have her come by. She provides concierge horticultural services all around the country through her business, The Garden Hoe. And so we'll talk about why some plants last so long, how to properly grow them, and we'll take your plant questions and ideas. So what's your favorite plant? What's your go-to plant to give as a gift? Join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Welcome back, Liz. Thanks for joining us. Happy Valentine's.
Happy Valentine's Day to you as well, and thanks for inviting me. Always love coming here.
And you brought me a Valentine's gift.
I did. I did not put it in a Valentine's card. I didn't want to send the wrong message.
Okay.
But yeah. What I brought you is a Convallia, which is sword bean, and it's not native to the U.S. And I don't think we have any chance that it's going to run rampant here. So I don't think we have to worry about it being invasive. But it's a beautiful member of the bean pea family, and it's a climber. And once it gets started, you can actually watch it grow. It will just take off. It's the Jack and the Beanstalk kind of bean, and it's fabulous.
I've got just a place for it, and I'm looking for, and I've got a nice trellis there that I
think it would
grow right up.
And it loves the heat, so hopefully we'll get some nice heat this year, and it should be just wonderful.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and that's probably not one of the hardy plants you were thinking about.
No, that's the oddball out of the whole thing, but you know, we have to look at what's fun also. So when we're looking at plants that do stand the test of time, sometimes they're not plants that are native to the U.S., even though I do encourage people to use natives and nativars because they have developed in the conditions that we have. And so that's one of the keys to longevity is either the plant adapts to what it's introduced to or it's developed in that area so that it is just developed along with the environment. A lot of the ones that people can't get rid of, and there's two camps on a lot of these things, like sedums. People love and hate sedums. Not really a halfway point.
Yeah.
And I'm personally not really fond of the tall sedums, but I love the short ones, and they do a beautiful job of filling. And each one of those has their own spot. So some of those that grow further south are not going to survive up here, so their longevity will be short. Hostas, that's another love-hate camp. either they do phenomenally and you're happy as a clam, or they do phenomenally and you wish they would go away. But that's not one that's native to us, but has adapted to our conditions beautifully. And you know, there's a lot of cultivars out there, but you know, there are some that have been brought here, and we have relatives that have developed in the U.S. Hydrangeas are one. Hydrangeas, oftentimes we'll see that they are just from Asia, but the arborescence, like the Annabelles, you know, the big ball hydrangeas, those are actually U.S. plants.
And they are.
Yeah. And they were found, the Annabelle itself was actually found in a woods by a couple of sisters who were riding horses. And so, you know, there are stories that go behind many of these plants, and there's many stories yet to be uncovered. But those are some of the hardy ones. Yes, we have irises, and we have lilacs, and peonies, peonies, you know, for us in the northern part of the country, we think, oh, you know, okay, a peony. Well, down south, they kill to be able to raise a peony. But they don't grow any further than about, I think one of the latest ones was Birmingham is what I had seen, that's where it's kind of moved to, where you can still grow them. But That's, you know, it's one of ours, and it can go all the way up into Alaska. And Alaska actually has phenomenal peony breeders that grow them for the flower market. So,
oh, you're kidding. I didn't know that.
No, they love the cold. They absolutely love the cold. And so when you look at peonies, there's so many wonderful cultivars out there that have been bred for strong stems, for powdery mildew resistance, and that's just in the herbaceous. Then we have the tree peonies, which oftentimes we look, you know, people will look at it and say, oh, that's like a tree rose, so you have to bury it. You have to, no. They love the cold. I have not seen one taller than about 5 feet, but there are some that can get upwards of 6 to 8 feet. And, you know, when you see a good 6-8 inch bloom on that, that size shrub,
striking.
Fantastic.
Yep. Very striking.
And those we treat like regular shrubs. So, you know, if you understand what to do with a shrub, it's not that bad. And then there's the itos, which is a cross. And, you know, so there are lots of plants out there. And now you might think, well, did you actually look outside there, Miss Ho, and see what it's doing? Yeah, okay. But Valentine's Day is in February. So what we really can do is order plants for, and, you know, this is great for people who have forgotten to get a gift for their loved one, whatever that loved one, whoever that may be. You can order a plant online and give somebody a card that says this will be delivered, you know, in May or June. You know, I love you. I didn't forget you. I'm going to tell you twice. Once now and once when the plant comes, you'll know for sure.
I got some in the mail the other day, that sage and rosemary and thyme. And they were in this box that it was amazing. Each plant was in its own kind of plastic tower. And it was I was absolutely amazed. And they were perfect.
Yeah.
They were perfect.
The packaging that companies have come up with to ship them is just
unbelievable.
So, and while we really do promote buying local, buying from your independent garden centers, you know, we have fantastic plant people in this state. We have Jung's. We have, you know, and there's a lot of independent ones that I'm not going to remember. We do have also a good online online company, and I think they're going to be done at the end of 2020, but Song Sparrow Farm is good online, and when they ship their stuff, not a little tiny piece of soil is out of place. Everything is just so they do a really good job.
Well, we should give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or a comment, love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to Adams and talk to Chris. Hi, Chris.
Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
To you as well.
About 2 weeks ago, I realized that the snow, gray stuff was getting to me, and that I was sort of sitting on my couch just wilting in the dread of winter and where it was at. And so I decided to go out, and I realized that Valentine's Day was coming up and the stores were stocking themselves up on all kinds of fun things. So I bought myself, because I have a whole pile of Facebook friends who are women in their 60s and early 70s who are just happy as heck that they're living by themselves, or either widowed or divorced and the kids are gone, and they're living their lives the way they wanted to for the first time in their lives, right? So I thought, well, I deserve this. I don't have to wait for somebody else to buy me flowers. So I went out and I bought orchids and hyacinth and paper whites.
Oh,
and I have a window full of wonderful purple and white and blue and pink things that are smelling wonderful and blooming, and everybody deserves that. You don't just go around and wait for somebody else to buy it for you, right?
You are so right. You are so right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because as gardeners, we cannot ever forget ourselves. And especially, like you said, for this time of the year, when it's gray and yucky, and, you know, when the snow melts, then it's brown and yucky. And I love the fact that you have a window full of fun.
I do, too. And you painted a wonderful picture there, Chris.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I love that. So buy one for yourself if somebody else isn't going to buy one for you. Or even if they are,
uh-huh.
Go pick what you want.
No, and you know, this, even buying seed packets for yourself right now is a real treat. And stocking up on those and getting ready to put them into the ground when it gets a little bit closer to potting time is a wonderful gift for yourself, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris, thanks again for calling. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Michelle had called in to ask for, and couldn't stay with us, she wanted advice about growing orchids for the last 2 years. And I said Michelle, but it's really Michael, sorry. His orchids are not growing any streams of flowers.
Okay.
Where have we heard that before?
We have heard that from almost everyone who's not a professional orchid grower. I've heard that when I've been talking to myself, you know, why didn't you get any? And, you know, the things that we look at when we're looking at orchids is, have they been fertilized? Because that's kind of important. And have they been watered on a regular basis? And do they need to be repotted? And oftentimes just satisfying those few little switches in your cultural care will actually encourage that to develop. They also don't like a lot of direct sun. So they like bright light, but not hot afternoon sun. So you might want to check to see where you have those orchids placed. Again, bright light, but not direct, and especially not afternoon sun. They also do like a pinch of cool weather. And so often what I hear from people who are very successful at growing them in and out is that they don't worry about having it too warm around where they're growing.
Yeah.
So a little bit of cool will help also.
Not next to the radiator.
Not next to the radiator.
Yeah.
No. So if they're getting a stream or a blast of horrible, horrible hot, dry air, that's not going to do them any good. And, you know, if it looks like the leaves are slightly desiccated or the stems and the roots are just not developing good, full, lush turgidity, then you really do want to look at, do I need to increase the humidity? And maybe get a small humidifier to be around the orchids.
Yeah, not a bad idea. Well, let's take a call from Judy in Waukesha. Judy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, I know Rising Sun Redbud has been out for a few years at least.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering, I thought Redbuds are susceptible to disease.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you know anything about how well they do in southeastern Wisconsin?
Not too bad. Waukesha, are you talking in a protected area or out?
In protected area. We live on a hill, so it does have some protection.
Okay. Rising Sun is really a nice cultivar. All red buds are susceptible to verticillium wilt. And so if you're looking at putting one in, you'll know if there's verticillium wilt in that area within 4 years. But if you haven't purchased it and put it in yet, what you might want to do, not today, but what you might want to do is get a soil sample from the exact spot that you're going to put that red bud in.
Oh, good idea.
And you can send it up to Brian and have it tested and see if he can pull verticillium out of there. And what I would do really is, if there's any plant material, whether that's turf, et cetera, there, I would include a little bit of the roots from whatever plant is there as well and a nice sample. But you can call Brian at the lab and he can explain what he would like best. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's the best one to do that. But that would actually give you a good idea if it's directly in that spot. Now, verticillium can be almost anywhere in our soil. We find it All over the place. So getting it tested is a good way to not lose your investment in that tree. But otherwise, they do okay here.
And it's Brian Huddleston at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. If you type that in, Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, UW, it's going to pop up.
Yep.
And we'll take some more calls here in just a second. Ramsey, we'll get to Ramsey from Waukesha in just a second. But just a reminder that we're visiting today with Liz Freemuth. Her business is called The Garden Home. She works with horticultural services across the country, or she provides it across the country to many folks. and here to answer your questions as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Engineer today, Tyler Ditter. Our on-air producer, Sasha Van Allen. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller with my guest, Liz Freemuth of The Garden Hole. Great to have her along, and thanks so much for joining us. Questions for her? Give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Ramsey in Waukesha, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hey there. I just have a couple comments regarding orchids. And just from experience and then also just taking a look around with different books. One is that it's a big fallacy about giving two ice cubes to your orchids, that one is they like more tempered water and the other you're not getting that water down to the roots of what they need. And the other thing is, which by accident I thought, oh, this needs to be replanted, and it's all these little tubers, I guess, that come up around. They're light colored green and almost furry looking. Mm-hmm. And they actually just need to be, they're taking moisture from the air. Mm-hmm. And they shouldn't be put underneath with all the different bark and stuff that you use for planting material for orchids. And so I just wanted to give those two comments out because I have just almost ruined orchids and they've come back.
I agree with you about the ice cubes. You know, my mother continues to do it and she has phenomenal results with her orchids. So I dare not say it when she's around. But what I have found is that actually burns the roots that you set them on. So unless you're actually putting them on the chips that are in there, it doesn't work. What I do and what I have seen recommended is soaking them. So and normally they're in a plastic pot. And you know, if you're repotting them into clay pot, then it takes a little bit more to do it. But I actually put them into nice clear water and let them soak for, you know, anywhere from a couple of minutes to 15. You know, really, mm-hmm. they're not that picky. Depends on how dry they are. Let them rehydrate, then let them drain and put them back into whatever container those plastic pots were in. But you don't want them to sit. One of the worst things you can do for orchids is wet feet. So, and, you know, getting, as Ramsey said, getting that water down to the base is super important. But not letting it sit there, definitely. And then making sure they get fertilizer. And what I do with that is I actually lightly fertilize the water that they soak in so that they can uptake it. And I only do that once every couple of weeks.
What a good idea.
And then they're fine. Then they can uptake as they want. And she's right. You know, the roots that are coming out, they need air.
That's why they're there.
That's why they're doing that. So she's absolutely right. Very good. I'm glad she called in to mention those.
Thanks again, Ramsey. Well, let's go to Jane in Mequon. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I have a newer landscape that I'm working with, and I'd like to do a lot of edible trees, shrubs, that sort of thing. I've been looking at a cornelian cherry, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering if you can tell me whether or not that would be appropriate. Do they grow well? I live in Mequon, just north of Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. The site is a little, it gets, it's on the west side of my house, northwest corner. Good afternoon sun for the most part. Just wondering what you think about that.
They are lovely plants. There are many different cultivars with different shapes to them. So you can get something that's a little bit more upright. You can get something that is more horizontal in nature once it gets up past the trunk. So really, North Milwaukee, I think you should be fine. I would be cautious to say all of them will do fine. Check the hardiness zone if you're buying it from a local supplier, a local nursery, and you've got great ones on the north side of Milwaukee. So if you're buying from them, they can actually make sure that what you're getting is going to be hearty for you. But no, that long life on them, they're an absolutely fantastic indicator plant for the landscape. And the fruit is wonderful. It does have a fairly large pit in it, but it is quite tasty. And it's about July or so that you can actually taste the fruit. But it's one of those first plants that starts to bud out in the spring. And so you'll see those beautiful yellow blossoms start opening up almost first thing in spring. They come out before the leaves do. And I would say, yeah, you've got a really good shot at doing well with that in the north side of Milwaukee.
So you got cherry trees. Jane, you were talking about all different kinds of fruit trees. Mm-hmm. What else?
Now,
Carnelian
cherry is actually a dogwood.
Oh.
And so it doesn't like, it's called Carnelian cherry, but it doesn't like wet feet. That's the only other thing with that. But what else can she use? There are some wonderful, wonderful things out there. Now, persimmon is a little bit that there is an American persimmon that clusters and it sends suckers out, but that might be a little bit too far north. I've had goji berry in the southern part of the state, and it's done okay. So that's another food crop. There's honeyberry, not a tree, but as long as you've got a pollinator for that, that comes from Siberia area, and so it's really quite hearty for us here and tasty. Has almost the taste of a blueberry, but elongated. It's kind of a funny-looking thing.
Oh.
And those actually do fairly well for us. Medlar, surprisingly. It's, you know, if you want to do some unusual things. Medlar is a fruit that's an old-time fruit. It really grown.
I don't even know that fruit.
It's related to, it's in the rose family, and it's kind of related to, it looks like an apple. You can treat it almost the same way you do an apple when you're growing it. And it's often called arsend fruit because the arsend looks a little interesting. It's got a very wide open bottom with little things sticking out of it. It's interesting. And it's hard as a rock. So when fall comes, it's hard as a rock. And so you store it, and you can eat that in the spring, and it gets soft, and it's almost like a custard, like an applesauce or a custard on the inside. Those we've grown, and they've done really quite well. Pawpaw, you know, for North Milwaukee, probably can get away with it with the climate changing slightly, and it does like moisture temperatures. Montmorency cherry, some of the plums, you know, Stanley plum or Santa Rosa, something like that. That would do well also.
Apples?
Apples would be fantastic too. And there's every kind of apple under the sun out there because they are just natural hybridizers. So you can find something. You can find something to put in. There's a lot of pears also that are very low maintenance. And when I look at putting something in my yard or even for clients, what kind of maintenance are you looking to invest in that plant in order for return? Pears are really pretty low maintenance. Asian pears do really well even that far north. Those are Korean plants, and where they're grown often there are colder climates like we have, and so you can actually grow them. And they're pretty low maintenance.
Yeah. I was thinking about some of the pear trees in my neighborhood where there's a couple that are right next to the sidewalk, and there's people have little signs out, go ahead.
Help yourself.
Which is great. I love that. Well, you can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. You know, Kevin wondered about advice for keeping his cat out of the succulent cactus that he has.
Good luck.
Yeah, that's
cats
a problem.
Cats have got their own way of living. About the only thing you could do would be to put, if it's inside, I would assume that this is inside, and it's in a container, you would almost have to surround that container with some sort of a net covering to keep the cat out. And even at that, I don't know that the cat couldn't get through that and get into it. If it's one that is true cactus and it has the spines on it that you have to worry about, I don't know what to tell you with that one.
No.
That's a cat question more than it is a plant question.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking just to keep the cats out of limey, my lime tree, I've just put aluminum foil.
Oh, they don't like that?
They don't like, you crinkle it.
Uh-huh.
You crinkle aluminum foil around the, and they do not like that.
Well, maybe he should try that with his around his cactus then, because that, you know, I honestly, other than physical barrier, I don't know what to do for cats.
Well, you could actually even, if it's a small plant, you could even put some aluminum foil right around the plant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not the best looking thing in the world, but
no. But if you want to keep both things, you know, if you don't want to have to make that choice, and you know, really, this is Valentine's Day. Let's be inclusive. Let's not be exclusive.
Lori in Vernon County, we'll go to you next. Hi, Lori.
Hello. I have a question about edible fruit trees, as you were speaking about, like the Carnelian cherry. When they breed those to be different, horizontal or whatever, does that make the fruit less edible, especially for birds? I noticed a lot of like cherry trees or some cherry-like tree they seem to be using as landscape trees in cities that, you know, even when their robins are starving in the middle of winter, they're not eating these cherries. So how do you know what's still edible for fruit when they're breeding for other stuff?
Got it.
That question still, I'm curious about cultivars of plants, especially native plants, mm-hmm. are they still useful as a plant?
they are. We'll attack that one first. When plant breeders or selectors are working with native plants, oftentimes they're selecting what nature has provided as a change in that original native plant. And or if they are breeding one with the other, then they are called it is called a cultivar. But what they're doing with natives is they're calling it nativar, so that you don't lose the idea that this is a native plant, that you do have the benefits of the native plant. I mean, with any kind of plant breeding, you are going to sacrifice a little bit of one part of the plant to get another part of it to become more prominent. I don't know of anybody who's gotten all the good points and none of the bad points. You know, that's just what happens. And so, no, you don't lose the benefit of the native plants completely and totally. And it really depends on what you're looking for as a benefit. So, you know, you can check through the nativars and the selections and see what people have chosen as those characteristics to actually prop up a little bit more. But no, and there's still, you know, there is a little bit of a resistance in calling them natives yet, and that's why they've gone to nativars. But I don't see that much of a difference, especially if you're somebody out selecting in nature what mm-hmm. nature has actually done for some sort of a blending of plants. But there, you know, there is always discussion on that. Plant people are very weird, and we love being weird, and so there will be discussion on all of those things. As far as the edible fruit on the Carnelian cherries, you may get some that are not going to be as tasty as others. And so if you're looking for a Carnelian cherry for the fruit in addition to its habit, then that's something that you specify when you're shopping for that plant. So when you're going to your local garden center, you're going to say, I want to be able to use the fruit and I would like a horizontal habit, and they should be able to find one for you that you can choose. You know, do you want it more horizontal or do you want the fruit more tasty? I've actually found the ones with the horizontal habit have a little bit better fruit, a little bit bigger fruit on them, but it depends on the year, too.
Yeah. Lori, does that help?
No, actually, it doesn't. I was
okay, what did I miss?
When you're using landscape scale, you know, when you're using plants in a landscape, and like, for instance, in city plantings, when they're planting for whatever, I observe that the fruit is not being eaten by birds. That's my concern, is animals. I don't care about the fruit for me, but I'm wondering how we can make it, you know, people aren't buying for, you know, they don't think about it. They see fruit out there and they say, oh, birds will eat that, but they don't.
Well, and you're absolutely right with that. What you're looking at are two different desired outputs. Normally, when you're looking at cityscape trees, what the city has to deal with is the cleanup of that fruit. And if the birds are not eating, and if they don't eat it at all throughout the year, the birds, the wildlife, whatever it would happen to be, then I agree with you, that's rather a waste. But if the city is the one who has put those in, you need to talk to the city about getting fruit, you know, trees, plants, et cetera, that have fruit that is more palatable to wildlife. They're probably responding to the complaints they get from the citizens who live along those roads that say, we don't want to have to clean up the fruit on the sidewalks. It's changing a mindset. And that's, as we all know, often a slow process and one that you have to work at continually. But it really, I think it's a shame also that the birds are not eating what is out there. We have to keep in mind that the birds will eat in an order. You know, they'll mm-hmm. take what's most palatable to them, and they will work down that order of what's available. So without, you know, have you noticed that they're not eating at all throughout the year, or just right now?
The birds have disappeared. We don't see them. And that's what I'm hoping that our experts on the radio can start addressing the extinction crisis in context of what we're planting. People plant, good-hearted people go and plant a viburnum thinking they're doing good for the birds, but they're not, because it's not... there's no food there, and that's what I want our experts to, but it's also not patentable. So I imagine that's where the university experts get into trouble talking about. So anyway, I'm worried about the extinction crisis we're in the midst of, and that we're not talking about it on the radio very often.
And it is a good topic to bring up, and what I like to do when looking at a landscape is look at all parts of it. And so it is nice to hear that people are concerned about providing food for our wildlife and keeping them healthy and happy. And I think looking at a landscape holistically is a fantastic way to do that on a small scale. So if we can encourage people to plant diverse plantings, to plant plants that are going to provide food and cover and homes for our insects, our birds, our wildlife, I think that's fantastic.
And Lori, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Lots of open lines get you on pretty quickly here as we talk gardening. We've gotten into trees and shrubs and flowers.
Yeah, and all of them are suitable gifts for Valentine's Day.
And suitable topics
there
as well.
That's right.
Steve emailed to ask for tips for growing,
it's prickly pear.
Prickly pear in containers, and he also wanted to know if these plants are gendered.
I don't know. That's not a plant.
Either.
That's not a plant I'm really familiar with. I'm not afraid to say I don't know. So that's what I am going to say, is I don't know. They are actually, did it say where he was from? They are actually hardy in many parts of Wisconsin. So I would suspect that because they are hardy, you could probably easily do container and just treat them like you would any other outside plant that you're putting into a container, would be my guess.
Yeah, and there are people who take them out in the summer and mm-hmm. bring them back in the winter. And
mm-hmm. But they are hardy. So
yeah, they're hardy.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember that we actually have more than one mm-hmm. cactus that's hardy here in the state. Quite a few, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and I honestly do not – it's not something that I deal with professionally, and so it's not something that I'm really well healed in. So I will defer to somebody else on that one. Sorry, Steve.
That's okay. What about Xavier from Avon, Minnesota, emailed to ask for advice about dividing a stilbe?
Oh, super duper easy on dividing a stilbe. If they have some age to them, they do need to be divided, definitely. And I would pop a nice wide tine fork down there, not today, and pull that planting up. And you can actually see where all of the little plants, they're separate plants in that clump. And you can take them out individually if you want to increase your numbers dramatically. You can actually take all of those out individually and pop them into the ground, or you can take clumps and just divide. You know, so you might have 6-7 little tiny ones into each clump that you're going to put back in the ground. But you can do spring with those. If you do spring, anytime you move a plant before it flowers, you may interrupt the flowering process. But you know, it's a trade-off. Do you want to move the plants or not? Otherwise, just wait until after they've flowered and then dig them up and move them to your heart's content. But really easily done.
Let's go to Cheyenne in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Cheyenne.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I actually just had a comment about the cactus and the cat question, because I have a couple of cats and I love plants, but my cats will eat aluminum foil.
So. Oh, they will?
Oh, yeah. No, they're rascals. They're the worst. Oh. I actually brought it up to... in Green Bay, we have a shop called The Plant People, and they were able to give me it's like a bitter apple spray, and I guess like that sour taste, it doesn't like smell or anything, but it tastes really bitter, and cats don't like that, so I sprayed my my plants that get the most chewing action from my cats. And also my Christmas tree, so that was really helpful.
And it kept them away from the Christmas tree also?
Not the bulbs, but yeah.
And have you noticed, is that, because that's not anything I'm familiar with using. I don't have cats. Does it change the plant at all? Do you see any leaf burning or anything like that with using it?
I haven't noticed anything so far. I don't use it very often because you don't really have to. You just put a couple spritzes on, like maybe the areas that get chewed on the most. I try to keep them out of reach of my cats, but you know, cats will find a way.
I would think if you hung them from the ceiling, the cats would still find a way.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I'll have to give it a try and just see what it does to plants. And it's a bitter apple spray for cats, huh?
Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Yep. There we go. Cheyenne, thank you.
Wonderful
no problem,
tip. Thanks. Wonderful tip.
I know it's used outside sometimes too for on plants.
I've seen it, but I have not used it. When you're dealing with a larger landscape, sprays can get kind of interesting using sprays. very much so.
Well, let's take some more calls, and you can join in too at 800-642-1234. Tina in Black River Falls. Oh. Hi.
Hi. I heard your comments on prickly pear cactus.
Yep.
And we actually have some in our backyard, and they are the southern exposure, and we just plant them in the ground, and we don't bring them in the summer or in the winter or anything. We
leave them.
And you have, what's your soil there? It's kind of a Black River Falls, more sandy soil, or is it?
Well, some of the soil is sandy, but some of it, like our soil is really heavy soil, but we did mix a little sand in with it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the spring, sometimes there's a few dead, you know, chunks. We've had to trim it back a few times, but it grows the most beautiful flowers, and they don't last real long, maybe a week at the most, a couple days. And we love it.
Now, and you've not tried growing them in containers?
No, it just is in the ground. It's under the eaves, so they don't get a ton of water. So it's just like the perfect location. We never water them. They just are there and exist.
Well, I've got a client down in Dunes National Park. So Dunes, of course, is sandy as all get out. And the prickly pear just pop up out of the ground periodically. But I've never tried to grow them in pots. So, again, I'm assuming that if you treat them like they would grow outside, that they grow in pots okay.
Yeah, I would think so. Tina, thanks.
Yeah, probably, great.
But, well, the only thing is with them, though, when you're messing with them and getting the leaves out of the area, their little pricklies come off real easily. So I don't know if I would recommend handling them without really, really good gloves on.
Yeah, that makes very good sense. Thank you very much for calling. Well, visiting today with Liz Freemuth, she owns her business. She provides concierge horticultural services throughout the country, actually. The business, the garden hoe. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us as we visit with Liz Freemuth of The Garden Hole. That's her concierge business. Great to have her with us today. And you can join in. Easy to get on here. Call 1-800-642-1234 with your gardening question, or maybe you've got a comment or experience to share. Mike in Madison up next with something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have a trellis that has, I believe it's a coreopsis that grows on it, and it blue flowers. They don't usually come out until like August or so. But anyway, I'm wondering, should I take off all that old foliage, and can I move that trellis at all?
Okay, what I think probably what you have may be a clematis or a clematis, depending on where you're from and how you pronounce it. Coreopsis is not a climber, and there's no blue color flower on that one. So is this something that climbs up your trellis and it gets maybe about 3 to 4 inch purpley blue flowers on it?
Yeah.
Okay, clematis. And it depends on what type of clematis it is as to when is the best time to prune it. Oftentimes, those little branches that look dead are not dead. And so it depends on which type it is as to whether you can or cannot prune it in the spring, summer, winter, fall. If you want to move it, though, go right ahead and move it. Just expect that it's going to take it a couple of years to rebound. And what you would do is, you know, honestly, if you want to remove the trellis itself, you're going to have to cut the vines down completely and totally, because I don't think you're going to be able to get it out of the trellis. No. But if you're okay, if you want to move the entire thing, then I would say you dig the base of that clematis out and gently pull up the trellis and move the whole thing if you want it to stay kind of how it is. You're going to lose some of it because disturbing the roots is always going to cause you to lose some top growth or slow it down, et cetera. But you can definitely do it. And if you do want to cut it back and just start over fresh from the ground, get the trellis out but leave the plant there, it will take it again a few years to come back and really start weaving its way back up. But you can certainly do it. If it's something that's been there for a while and it's healthy, you don't have to worry. It'll come back.
And it's probably a two-person job if you're using the trellis.
Yes, I would agree.
I'm trying to think of how to do it without somebody else, and I can't.
Well, I have, you know, it is doable, and I will tell you what comes in really, really handy is actually a packing blanket. And what you can do is if, and especially if the trellis is like against a fence or a wall or something, you get the packing blanket behind it and sort of wrap it around. And then pull the trellis, you loosen the roots, and then you kind of pull that trellis out slightly, lay it down on the ground, hold it tightly, get something around the base of the roots, and you can actually move it that way. Yes, I have done it.
I was going to say, you must have. Oh, man. Mike, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Marilyn in Fond du Lac up next. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I was wondering if you can grow bamboo in Wisconsin.
You can. Is there a particular reason why you want bamboo?
Just because it's interesting.
Okay. And are you looking for the bamboo that's big that you get bamboo stakes out of?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not sure how many of those actually do grow in Wisconsin, but it is a horribly invasive plant. Most of them are. There are some cultivars that are clumping as opposed to runnering. And those that will run definitely do run, and they are hard as the dickens to kill. And they will actually crowd out almost anything else you have. I know in some areas, and actually in Asheville at Biltmore Estate, they have groves of bamboo that have just gotten out of control. And you know, it was put in to get a certain look. And bamboo is beautiful. There are so many different looks that you can get with bamboo, coloration and style, et cetera. But a lot of them are invasive, even this far north. And controlling them is not very possible. I know even in Georgia, one garden that I was at, she had it planted in an old silo. And the silo staves went down underground about good 8-10 feet, and it still managed to escape that and get out and grow. So really, you know, I would be really careful with that. But there are clumping forms that do not spread as horribly. So if you're looking for that look of bamboo without them getting out of control, look for a clumping form of bamboo. And, you know, that will help out.
Otherwise, you will rue the day.
And so will your neighbors.
And so will the neighbors.
Yeah. And bamboo, some of them are so insidious that they will actually start to go through basements. You know, so we are talking about some horrible stuff. And, you know, where it has taken off, like down by Biltmore, they actually provide that for zoos as feed. But they still have a heck of a time keeping up. Yes, it's impressive, but be careful with that one.
Horseradish came to mind, too, when we were talking.
Oh, yes.
I made that mistake once. Oh, my goodness.
Many years ago, I had a gentleman ask me about horseradish, and he had said, his wife said, don't put it in the perennial bed. Well, while she was gone one day, he put it in the perennial bed, and he called, this was maybe a year or so after, and he said, okay, what do I do? And it's like, go buy her some jewelry, because boy, this is not going to get any better anytime soon. And so the perennial bed ended up becoming the horseradish bed, and the perennials had to move elsewhere, and it cost him a pair of earrings. So, yeah, so be careful with that.
Oh, man. Well, Marilyn, thanks again for calling with that question.
Yep.
You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Bob in Crivets. Hi, Bob.
Hello, good morning. Okay, I heard you talk. I'm on my way to my cabin. Okay, I heard you talking about prickly pear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I didn't hear anybody talking about it being edible.
It is.
Okay. Pardon?
It is.
Yeah, I've eaten it. I'm a survival instructor when I was in the military.
Mm.
Okay, and I lived in the mountains for 2 years, and I've eaten prickly pear. Okay, the biggest thing with it is to get the clean your knife blade off every time. Okay, I had 13 prickers in my tongue one night.
Ouch!
Okay, the leaves taste about, from what I can remember, this is back in '65. It's about like a white melon, but it's not that sweet. Okay,
oh.
And the pear itself is edible as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but again, you got to be super careful. Okay, so you take a slice off like you're peeling a potato. Okay, now wipe that blade off completely and then double check it, because those little prickers are so fine. Okay, and that's how I, sitting around a campfire, that's how I had 13 of them in my tongue.
Oh.
From what I can remember, it's very good tasting.
13 of them, Bob. Oh, my goodness me.
I love it. I've not had prickly pear. I've not eaten prickly pear. I will admit to having prickly pear margarita, but I've not eaten it. I've not eaten the fruit itself.
Prickly pear margarita?
It was quite tasty.
Oh.
It was in California. It was quite tasty.
Well, here we have Terry with an email. They have a lot of wild milkweed, but never see monarch worms on them. Is this the wrong kind of milkweed? But no.
Mm-mm.
Wild works.
Yeah, it does. It may be that you don't have a huge population of monarchs in your spot. If you're seeing the monarchs themselves, it might be that you're just missing the worms also.
And there are other plants. I mean, the monarchs don't live...
Mm-hmm.
Totally on milkweed.
Mm-mm. No, and it's just going to depend on, do they want that at that point in time also? Is that the best food for them in that location? There may be something more desirable to them in your yard than the milkweed.
Yeah, or in your neighbor's yard.
Exactly.
Yeah. Jane in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi there. I have a question about growing majesty palms indoors. They're very large, about 5-6 feet. And so I've had them almost through 1 year, but they've developed a scale problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I was using neem oil. Is that the best thing, do you think, for controlling scale?
Yeah. Now, scale is interesting in control. You can actually pick all of those scale off of the plant and then you can use neem oil or even a good horticultural soap and clean that plant off after you've picked it. So in case there were any babies underneath that hard shell, that you got them in that soft shell stage. Because when you see that hard scale on the plant, that's actually the home where the babies are going to grow. And so underneath that, if you get out a magnifying glass, you will see a whole bunch of little soft-bodied critters. So if you don't catch them, if you don't pick all the scale off and you don't get them that way, you watch to see when they start crawling around. And if you can catch them when they're in that crawler stage, you've got a window, depending on the scale species, you've got a window of about 7 to 10 days to get that treated. And if you can catch them in that soft body stage, a good horticultural soap will work beautifully on them because that suffocates that soft body and kills them. Once they're in that hard stage, you can't get through that outer shell easy and get them dead. And that's what you want to do.
You want them
dead.
Not a long lingering kind of death.
Nope, we want them dead with prejudice. Thank you very much. Because they will just continue to grow and grow and spread and spread. So yeah, but neem oil does work also.
We are so blessed to have Liz Freemuth with us today. Liz is she provides concierge horticultural services through her business called The Garden Whole. Always fun to have her with us for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest Liz Freemuth back in the studio with us. She provides concierge service through her business, The Garden Whole. Always great to have her on because we usually talk about a whole wide range of things. We zeroed in a little on plants that sort of stand the test of time, but we've taken all kinds of questions. So join in 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. Leslie in Cottage Grove, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Leslie.
Good afternoon. Hi there. My question is, I planted a wisteria plant right next to my house in celebration of my daughter's braces way back when. She's in her 30s. How do I get rid of the wisteria plant, and will its roots go into the basement? You were mentioning that about, I think it was bamboo. Mm-hmm. But do I have a potential problem there? I'm having trouble getting rid of it.
That does not surprise me. And you know, I know people who would trade their problem of not being able to get it to grow with yours. But, you know, when wisteria is happy, it is really, really difficult to get rid of. About the only way that you can do that is to cut off wherever you're seeing those shoots come up out of the ground and immediately paint them with some sort of weed killer. And you just have to continue to do that, and eventually you'll get rid of it. I actually have seen wisteria weave its way through wherever there is a crack. So if you're safe if your foundation doesn't have a crack in it, but many do. And especially if it's been there for a while, you know, the way things move in this part of the country and the moisture, et cetera, you can get cracks. So you might want to check on the inside to see if you have a crack that's coming through. But yeah, plants will find their way in if they so choose. Wisteria, again, tough to get rid of. And I have had them take down pretty substantial structures that they've been on. So a nice pagoda, if there's even a slight bit of weakness, it'll pull it down. It's laughing at you and just kind of lassoing the structure and pulling. So good luck with that, but there are ways to do it. Just keep at it. Don't pull, but cut. If you pull anywhere where you break that root or that stem, you're going to have more growth shooting out from that. So,
like quackgrass.
Exactly. And like Creeping Charlie and a lot of plants like that. So your best bet, mint, your best bet is just to cut them off at ground level, paint some sort of a weed killer on that, and just keep at it, and you should get rid of it that way.
And thanks for calling.
Yeah, definitely.
Denny in Madison, your turn. Hi, Denny.
Ooh.
Denny,
oh,
are
hi
you
there? Sorry.
Oh.
I am. I'm here. Sorry about
okay.
that. I am calling about jumping worms,
mm-hmm.
wondering if you have any suggestions for how to get rid of them, how to manage them, and also how to supplement my garden if, because I know that I have them there, if I can try to just manage them or, I guess, continue to grow my plants where they already exist.
I think managing around them is probably going to be your best bet. People who know jumping worms better than I do may have some sort of specific suggestion on how to treat them with heat, et cetera. I don't know, what else are they suggesting, Larry? You probably have more exposure to it than I.
I'm just not remembering. There is not a chemical, but a granular thing that has had some success. But. Mm.
And do you know who's recommending that? Would it be the entomology department or is it forest?
I think in Denny's case, you might call Lisa Johnson at the Dane County horticulture specialist, and she would. I know she's had to deal with them herself.
Okay,
and we were talking about it on the show one day, and there were a couple of comments about you're not going to get rid of. I mean, Madison's kind of like
manage.
The jumping worm capital of Wisconsin mm-hmm. right now because they're all over the place in the city. So I would call Lisa Johnson.
Well, for Madison, she's a phenomenal resource.
Yeah,
absolutely phenomenal.
She's great. Or email her.
Mm-hmm.
At the Dane County, she's the Dane County Extension, UW Extension. Let's see here. We've got Ken in Deerfield with something for us. Hi, Ken.
Hey, how you doing, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hey, my question is, our house has several burning bushes of unknown age. They were there when we moved in, and they're very hardy and they do very well. But kind of in mid-late summer for the last 2 years, we've gotten really bad spider mite infestations of them. And I'm wondering if there is something I can do preventatively to maybe stop them instead of catching them in the act and then having to hose the tree or the bushes down with, stuff like Talstar or like nasty insecticides for weeks and weeks because they're very hard to get rid of. And 2 years ago, the first time we didn't notice it until it was quite late and they had webs everywhere and they completely defoliated the bushes, in like July, which was really bad. So they came back OK, but I'm just trying to see if did they winter over? Is there some kind of way that I can, prevent them from coming back?
I have a couple of questions for you. Do you use lawn chemicals or any other types of chemicals in the landscape much?
I do, but usually I use organic fertilizers like Milorganite or
okay.
Milorganite or however you pronounce it, things
mm-hmm.
like that. So I know that does have a fair amount of natural phosphorus in it. But yeah, I do try to, I am kind of a lawn nerd.
Okay, so if you are a lawn nerd and you're using any kind of weed control or insect control product on your lawn, that can actually increase the incidence of spider mites just because it can get rid of the beneficials that would eat the spider mites normally. And so if you're a lawn nerd, you're not really going to get away from that. And I'm not saying, don't use anything on your lawn to keep it green and keep it happy and weed free, but that may be contributing to it. And there may, and spider mites, they're going to hit when it's hot and dry, and they're going to hit spots where there are not insects, predatory insects and beneficial insects to feed on them. So you may have to take a look at what systems are in place, what you're using for control, and see if maybe you can time that a little bit differently so that you're not getting rid of those predatory insects.
And something that makes sense, because I do, when the summer gets nasty and we have lots of mosquitoes, I do occasionally fog
right.
from mosquitoes, which of course nukes all kinds of beneficial insects, I'm sure.
Exactly. So it's a balancing act, most definitely, with that. And you can actually use, on spider mites, it's not as good as using something that is specifically for spider mites, but you can use horticultural soaps or appropriately weighted oils can sometimes help keep them under control a little bit. But you do need a miticide specifically for mites rather than a whole-scale insecticide for spider mites. They don't always work as well on those spider mite populations as a miticide does. And you're looking at a couple different ways that those insects are controls, products that control them. So if it isn't specifically a miticide, you may want to look at doing that or looking at something a little bit lesser in intensity. And sometimes even just spraying them with water can help keep the populations down somewhat. It's not going to completely take care of it. But then timing when, you know when your spider mites are hitting. So if you can kind of time and maybe lessen your application of mosquito control, that might help you out a little bit.
There you go.
All right, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. And let's go to Jane next in central Wisconsin. Hi, Jane.
Hello. I'm calling for a friend today who's too busy doing his taxes. he would like to know how to get rid of June bug larvae from the soil.
Are we talking June bugs? We're not talking about any other kind of insect, but specifically June bug larva?
That's what he said, yes.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I've never really had anybody ask me that. I would think anything that controls larvae of any kind would do it. So the Japanese beetle larva control would probably take care of it also. Is there a specific reason why he wants to control June bugs?
All right. That's why I told him to call himself. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. So I would say generally then, if you're trying to control larvae in the soil, it's about product going down at the time when those larvae are reachable by that product. So that means that you would be looking at a May or depending on me, you're going to have May bugs that come out as well that are a little bit ahead of June. But I don't know that I've ever had anybody ask me about controlling June bug larvae.
I haven't. I don't remember it ever coming up on the show.
Yeah. So
that's,
I think, you know, and the thing about insects is that if you control them in your yard, if the neighbor doesn't control theirs,
well,
their
June bugs
are
fly a long way.
Exactly. And so they're going to be in his yard anyway. So to me, it would be, okay, why do you want to control them? There has to be, everybody has a reason. So it's like, why do you want to control them? And that will give him an idea of how to approach control. And if it is damage that he thinks he's getting on his lawn, et cetera, it might not actually be June bugs that are doing it. It might be a different larva that's hitting it. It might be Japanese beetles or something else that's coming up out of the ground. So I think identifying why, and then specifically, is that what he's dealing with, and then getting a control mechanism.
And the insect diagnostic
yep.
lab at
PJ,
UW,
yep.
If he's got a photo of one,
mm-hmm.
we can
mm-hmm.
get that identified, and then measures can be suggested, or
mm-hmm.
PJ certainly could.
Yeah,
but it's the
PJ
UW,
can,
yeah,
PJ can walk him through that one too.
UW
definitely.
Insect Diagnostic Lab, Jane.
Thank you very much, and you did give good advice. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, let's go to Judith next in Milwaukee. Hi, Judith.
Hi. I'm looking for a suggestion or two on a shrub that I want to put in my front yard. I have an east-facing yard that gets sun pretty much all of the day. I'm taking out a witch hazel that has been kind of a disappointment to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I want something. I have a lot of perennials in my yard, but I don't have something kind of big and showy in that particular spot, and I don't have a lot of things that show up early enough in the spring. So with that in mind, something like a showy shrub
mm-hmm.
and a springtime bloom, maybe.
I have a beautiful shrub for you. You may have to actually, you can try your local garden centers, but you may actually have to order this one online. It's an Abelia, A-B-E-L-I-A, Mosoniensis, and M-O-S. You put that in, Abelia, M-O-S, dot, search that online, and you'll find it. It actually, Abelias generally don't grow this far north, but this particular species does. And the scent is out of this world in spring. It's early spring. And for me, it's one of those hack and whack shrubs that I love. So it blooms first thing in the spring. And so it blooms on the old wood, and you can cut it back until, probably about July, August or so. And depending on the year, we're still going to have enough time in the season to grow and develop those blooms. But the scent is unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable. And an easy shrub to grow. It'll tolerate a whole lot of conditions. It's not the showiest shrub leaf-wise, but flower and scent, if that's what you're looking for early spring, it will definitely be there for you in that regard. Calycanthus is also another one. It's C-A-L-Y-C-A-N-T-H-U-S. And there are a number of different cultivars out there. If you go with species, the scent can be, you're kind of taking your life in your hands with the scent on that one. But if you have a named cultivar that is known for fragrance, it will be wonderful for you. It smells like a bowl of fruit. Athens is one cultivar that I've tried this far north, and it does beautifully. The common name is Carolina sweet shrub, and it does grow in the Carolinas, but again, I've had no problem with it whatsoever, no matter where I've put it. I think if we go to northern Wisconsin people don't call me, it probably will not live up that far, but I would say easily up to Madison and a little bit beyond. There are some pink flowering ones that are just as good, and that one will smell about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And so it's a good cocktail shrub if you like to wander about with a glass of tea or wine, what have you, in the afternoon and look at your garden. You're going to be rewarded with a lovely, lovely fragrance. And lilacs are always a good choice. There are some smaller ones, and there are also some rebloomers now so that you can get them in the spring and then also again in about August or so. And you don't have to prune them back in order to get them to rebloom. There are some that they're breeding now for smaller stature that are going to be better for kind of the average size home yard or next to the house, as opposed to being a 12-footer. So that's just a couple of suggestions for you.
You know, when you were talking about that cocktail 4 o'clock time, I got to thinking about a tobacco plant.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. That beautiful, wonderful aroma. Not tobacco aroma.
No. It's a very floral.
Yeah.
Almost soft kind of. I mean, it hits you, but it's not so
not
in your face. Yeah, it's not horribly in your face. But those and the ones that I mentioned are really easy things to grow. I'm not about putting something in that's going to require 8 hours out of every day to make sure it lives. That's not fun as far as I'm concerned. And so these will actually do very well for you. And the Abelia has a scent similar. It's a very floral scent. It has scent similar to some of the lesser scented jasmines.
Judith, thanks so much and good luck. Appreciate it. You know, Martha emailed, and I wanted to get her email in here because she and her husband found a beautiful specimen of horse chestnut tree last summer. They'd never seen one quite like it. Is it a good choice for a Wisconsin yard? She says they do have a sunny spot for one.
Yes, they are. They will do very well for you here. The flower differences are unbelievable. They will have long, long panicles of blooms on them, and probably racemes is more correct. And you can get yellow. You can get sort of a reddish pink. You can get just so many different colors and lovely leaves on those. To me, they look like a hand. You know, it's just that nice fingered palm looking and very, very lovely. And yes, they do fine here.
Let's go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. I was wondering. I work for this woman in the spring and the summer, and I noticed that she has wild strawberry in her yard, and it has taken over some of the beds. And there are other plants in there, so I don't want to, you know, destroy those plants by using weed control or anything like that. So I was just wondering how I can go about removing it completely, or is it just a lost cause and I'll just have to keep picking and picking?
Never a lost cause, but question for you, and that is it truly a wild strawberry, or is it the ground cover barren strawberry?
That's a good question, actually.
Does it get fruit? Do they get fruit on them?
They do, yes.
Edible fruit? Have you tried them?
I have not tried them. The woman I work for, she's tried them, and she said they're a little bit bitter.
Okay, then that may not be like an alpine strawberry or wild strawberry that we actually do have growing wild around here periodically. I know I have them in my yard, and I just kind of ignore them, mow them over, and they're fine. But if they're starting to move into the beds, that can be a problem. If it is the barren strawberry that is often used as a ground cover, the leaves will actually be a little bit bigger and they will be very, very thick. It's not like a domesticated strawberry plant where you'll get the clusters of root and a plant and they'll send out runners, etc. This seems the ornamentals just go like gangbusters all over the place, and they can be very, very difficult to get under control. I know in one instance we actually had to take a part of the landscape out of complete and total plants for two, going on 3 years before we got the barren strawberries under control. So at first it will depend on exactly which one you're dealing with, because if it is a fruit, if it's a, you know, wild one that still has fruit on it, halfway decent fruit, that's going to be a little bit easier to control. Then you just get in there and get those plants, those clumps of plants out. Mm-hmm. If it's the other one, you may end up having to redo the beds, unfortunately.
Oh, there you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Dennis in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Sometimes I've noticed there's some milkweed leaves that are partially eaten, but I don't notice any monarch caterpillars. So I search around, finding, well, maybe wind has knocked them down or they've been washed down by rain, try to save them, but I don't find any. So I was wondering, well, maybe I'm just not hunting enough, or maybe something else eats the leaves.
Something obviously is eating the leaves, and it may be that they're out there eating when you're not there, but it's not just going to be monarchs that are, you know, that are eating the milkweed.
No, there are a lot of other insects that inhabit milkweed. Some are there to get the monarch.
To get the monarch itself.
Larva, yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're going to find a lot of different ones out there. And I don't know if they feed at night or if it's daytime. I'm not sure.
You know, it's amazing the difference in what's active at night and during the day. You go out with a flashlight, walk in the middle of a patch of plants and flip that on, you'd be amazed at what you see.
Yeah. Ardell in La Crosse, you have a quick thing for us.
I have grown moonflowers in my backyard, and I just love them. They set a lot of seeds every year, and I pretty much weed and let them grow wherever I want them, mm-hmm. to fill in bare spots. And they bloom after the sun goes away. So on the east side of my house, they're blooming, you know, as soon as the sun goes over the top of my house.
Mm-hmm.
Moonflowers.
Moonflowers are beautiful. They're related to morning glories, but, you know, like here they're not, they're not invasive. And we don't get them to over winter. So getting the seed and putting it back in is about the only way we can do it. But I agree with you, Ardell. They are absolutely gorgeous. They're huge. They're like the size of a saucer and beautiful white. And it's a good reason to have people over when they're blooming and have a glass of something outside and enjoy.
And on that note, I tell you what, Liz, it's been a great pleasure. You'll be back for sure in June.
Yes, I will be definitely here in June.
Liz Freeman. Her business is called The Garden Hoe, and she provides concierge horticultural services through that business across the country. She works everywhere. Great to have her with us. And certainly it's great to have you listening in, and I hope you'll stay tuned because there's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.